Hi, and welcome to another episode of Django Chat. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent.
Hi, Carlton.
Hi, Will. And today we have special guest Adam Johnson with us. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Carlton and Will.
Thank you for coming on. So, Adam, you're going to have to tell us about yourself. So, who are you and how did you get into Django? Let's begin there.
Yeah, I am a member of the core team since 2016, but I started working with Django back in 2012 at my first full-time job, Memrise. Since then, I've worked with Django at other companies, Yplan, Timeout, Genus AI, and now I am a contractor offering services under my company, AWS, Adams Web Services.
So now in university, had you done anything with web frameworks before Django?
I actually started building my first website when I was 11 years old as a little freelancer. I was paid a very small sum for building the podiatry website for a friend of the family's business. And then when I was 16, me and my brother set up a shareware service offering a game creation software. As Red Spark Studios. And for that, we had a PHP website with no framework. So I'd kind of experienced the world of frameworkless web development, just
and PHP.
Throwing some files on a server. Yeah. The classic PHP.
Yeah. Crack open the template, open the tag, start writing some stuff. Yeah, yeah. That's good.
Well, I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned Memrise. So I was at Quizlet, I think at the same time, or maybe some overlap, and Quizlet was a PHP no framework site. So.
Oh, really?
Because it was originally built in 2005. The founder when he was in high school. So there was lots of learnings around that fun. But it's still going. It's scaling.
Had it developed a kind of internal framework or was it?
Yeah, I think it was just pieced together is the honest answer. And sort of Frankenstein, and you know, that's not uncommon. Especially when, you know, the creator was young and it was pre these really great PHP frameworks like Laravel and stuff. So you know, it was hosted on Joyent servers, you know, so it was a long time ago, 14 years ago, setting up a website. I mean, way more complicated across the board. I mean, payments, ads, all that stuff was just light years more complicated.
I think deployments were easier because you'd drag and drop the folders onto the server.
Well, the joke is the rsync and the can of beer, right? It's just watch it upload. And if it didn't work, you just re-upload it and edit it live and FTP. And oh, yeah, it's done. Yeah, it's fixed.
At Memrise, were you the only web developer on the team? Is that correct? When you were there?
No. There was a period when I was the only web developer.
Okay. Because it was quite a large site. Because I know the founders knew each other back. This is 2010 to 13 when I was at Quizlet. And we knew of Memrise and, you know, even back then.
Yeah, I was at Memrise 2012 to 2014.
Okay.
And in around mid-2013, there was like quite a big staffing change. So we ended up with one person looking after the mobile app, me looking after the website, and a part-time contractor handling DevOps where the servers needed rebuilding effectively. So that's when I learned quite a lot of the depths of MySQL and the value of doing DevOps properly.
And was it always Django? Was it Django before you came onto it?
It was Django before I came onto it, yes. And I remember doing the Django tutorial and thinking, oh, wow, all this structure to building a website. This is just fantastic.
Right. Especially coming from, from PHP without a framework.
Yeah. One of my first 2 weeks, I did the tutorial and I was like, yeah, I've been using it since.
And you've been a MySQL fan ever since too, right? I mean, because Memrise was dealing with a lot of data even back then. And so I'm sure you got to roll up your sleeves and feel some real database scaling fun.
Yes, I remember I had to sit down and read the MySQL book for scaling websites called High Performance MySQL. And that's by some of the key people in the MySQL community, like Peter Zaitsev, the CEO of Percona, who are a MySQL consultancy. Just digging through that.
We used Percona at Quizlet. We had them at the highest tier of retainer, and they were very needed.
Yeah, we hadn't quite hit that scale, I don't think, when I was working there, but we had a lot of data. Like one table was 100 gigabytes.
Oh, wow. Well, we also had, again, growing pains. And it's been a long time, and Quizlet's big, and so I don't think Andrew minds me telling this. But at one point, we didn't really have much permissions. I mean, we had two developers at the time, or when I first joined, two developers. And Andrew went in to delete a record and dropped the entire database by accident. So that was a fun 5-6 hours, and we called it Percona, like, hey, we need some help here.
You know those backups you said we had?
Yeah. No, but they set the gold standard for a consultancy, because we had, generally scaling or whatever challenges, and we weren't, experts, and it would always be someone different, usually in Eastern Europe, and they would just almost immediately be able to diagnose and fix the problem. It was pretty miraculous, actually.
Yeah, one of those things where they just know everything about the system inside out. I definitely got the impression reading the book and their blog posts that they know everything there is to know about MySQL.
Yeah, I mean, we almost couldn't pay them enough. It was just, even though it was a lot, I was just blown away that they always knew it. And I guess it makes sense, though. I mean, they're consultants. They've seen, that was our first time building a site at scale, but they've been through it, so the issues were not unusual.
So Adam, like you mentioned, you're part of the core team, and the sort of the thing you're known for there is working on the ORM and working on the MySQL side, and you maintain Django MySQL package as yeah. well. So could you tell us a little bit about that? What that does yeah, sure. and what that so brings that, to the table?
Yeah, the package is how I got invited into the core team. So the package is unoriginally called Django MySQL. We were using MySQL at YPlan as well, and I saw Django Contrib Postgres come in from Mark Tamlin's great work and the Kickstarter there, and I got a bit frustrated that MySQL could do some of these things as well, and we had some use for this feature or that feature. So I first developed some stuff in-house, and then I was very gratefully given the chance to open source it under my own name. And then it kind of snowballed from there. I tried to cover as many features as possible. I found it quite enjoyable just writing Django fields and things like that, and making a package well tested. And then at the third Django Under the Hood, I had quite a long chat with Josh Smeaton, who's also a core member. And a few months later, unexpectedly, I found myself invited into Django Core. It was a very nice experience, just seeing everyone who'd voted for me and that I'd had some impact with my work.
Okay, nice. That's super. And so my story, I began with PHP and MySQL back in the day, and I was using it very happily for a long, long time. And then, the whole Contrib Postgres thing came along, and I started using Postgres because I wanted the extra functionality that was available. And all of a sudden, over the course of 2-3 years, MySQL just dropped away. And I think now, for me personally, and I think Postgres now is in a position where it has a lot of the mind share, but it's not necessarily it may be the most capable database or not, but what has MySQL got to offer for us that perhaps we're in this Django world where Django comes packaged with this extra functionality for Postgres? Why should we be considering MySQL? Because I think that's a great topic for users.
Yeah, I think MySQL's had a bit of a troubled past after its acquisition by Oracle. As Oracle have their own database as well, so they've been seen as not focusing on MySQL's development, and it definitely lagged behind feature-wise from Postgres in many respects. But now the ecosystem there is a bit stronger. So Percona, who we were talking about, maintain their own fork where they have a number of fixes that they've merged in from their consultancy experience. And then there's MariaDB, which is a completely hard fork at this point that implements features faster, has a faster release cycle, and is effectively the Postgres of the MySQL world at this point.
And so
it's fully open source.
And if I'm a user, should I really be looking at MariaDB? If I'm,
at this point, yes. In my recommendation, at least. If you're maybe more of a corporate user, you might still want to look at MySQL because Oracle's bigger, and maybe it'll be easier for you to get a contract with them.
Right, okay. You can get a support contract, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Right. But I think MariaDB's in a better position going forwards. The place that I think MySQL shines over Postgres still is in replication.
Okay.
So Postgres has had like a load of different replication methods in the past, and then they've eventually merged one into the core after changing their minds that replication should be something the server should do.
Right, okay.
Whereas MySQL has had it from the start and is a lot more flexible. One use case I've seen a few times is having a replica of your master database, but still being able to write to it on perhaps a different table. And you can't do this in Postgres. One of my clients who I'm with right now, they just like dump and load the database every hour or so into a replica so that they can have a writable replica.
The take home there would be that for scaling up for big data, you think MySQL's got is more competitive in that area.
Yeah, okay. I think there's probably more big distributions of MySQL in the world than Postgres.
Okay, interesting.
By quite a lot of.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Orders of magnitude, like Facebook is MySQL, YouTube is MySQL. I don't think, last time I looked, none of the Alexa top 100 were Postgres.
Right, okay, and that's got to tell you something, you think.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, interesting.
But maybe that's also just like sampling bias, right? Like maybe these companies started to exist and scaled up and fixed MySQL on the way. And if you wanted to create a big company, you could also use Postgres and fix the problems on the way.
Okay. And so out of the features that Contrib Postgres gives us, what does Django MySQL give us?
I think it about matches it. The key thing is the JSON field, which you and I are both mentoring for an implementation in core that works on all database backends.
Yeah, so hopefully that will be in 3.0. It's close. We should get there, hopefully, fingers crossed.
Yeah, but when I started, like Postgres had it. MariaDB had just implemented it in MySQL. But it wasn't clear that there's like complete overlap with all the databases yet. So if you're on MySQL or MariaDB today and you want to use a JSON field, then you can use Django MySQL.
Yeah, okay. And I mean, the thing is as well, like anything that's in the core ORM is going to have to be support all the four databases, going to have to support MySQL and MariaDB, Postgres, Oracle, and SQLite or SQLite, which maybe it can't do, but in reality, your project isn't using four databases, it's using one. So if you're on MySQL, or you're looking into MySQL, you can use your package, right?
Exactly. And there are a few little extras in there that will never work on other databases because they're some feature that MySQL implemented ages ago.
Yeah, okay.
One thing I found useful is the user locks. So you can use MySQL or MariaDB as a locking server with a string. So you can create a lock per, say, user if you need that. And in Postgres, they have such a feature, but you only get to lock by an integer between 1 and 4 billion. So even having two applications on the same database server becomes a problem.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
This is my own ignorance, but does MariaDB MySQL have the same sort of full-text search support that Postgres has built in?
It does not have exactly the same. There's Sphinx, which I think you can use under MariaDB, but I've never really tried. It has a basic full text search, but it's definitely more basic than Postgres is.
Yeah, I mean, back in the day, I used to use that, and that was like kind of the okay first, well, poor person's, you know, search that you could use it, and it worked, and it was not bad. And if you didn't want to scale up to, you know, a proper search engine.
Well, I asked just because I'm giving a talk at DjangoCon this fall where I need to learn a little bit more about the Postgres options because I'm aware of them in the abstract, but I haven't implemented myself. So that's sort of an excuse to get to do that. Always a good idea with talks, be like, oh, I wish I knew more about this. Let me propose a talk on it.
Yeah. Well, I think I have an open ticket on Django MySQL to add some of the extra search support like Django Contrib Postgres has. So if you want to look at that.
Right. And actually, I had one more question. Since you're both core, you guys mentioned Oracle still gets support. Who's working on Oracle in the open source world? Like, how does that keep up with, you know, the other ones where you have folks like yourself, Adam, who are doing such great work? that's sort of an open question. Like, is it just sort of chugging along? Because I don't get the sense that anyone on their free time is, you know, keeping Oracle current with Django. But
well, no. Well, like Marius is our sort of who's the other Django fellow at the moment. He's our sort of Oracle superstar. He knows it really well. He knows all the different versions and the new versions come up, and he makes sure it's maintained. And he, you know, if an issue comes in that, you know, there's some incompatibility with Oracle 12 point whatever, and he's in there and he knows the details. And, you know, without Marius, we'd be in trouble there. He really takes that on.
We haven't had him on the show yet. No, I don't know him personally, but I assume there's one or many people doing that work to keep it up. So I was just curious who they were.
I think at this point it's one. I know Josh Smeeden used to, but changed job and then doesn't want to touch Oracle again, effectively. I think that's what Oracle does to people.
No, but like we have to get Marius on now because we're not going to defend it, but he will defend it. And he's like, look, it's not so bad. It's nice. It's got these things. And, you know, he'll tell us all about what the positives are.
And shouldn't Oracle fund Django a bit as the only paid database? Cool.
Yeah, don't get me started. Yes, they should.
Okay. Yes.
I think you're more likely to see Microsoft funding before Oracle funding.
Well, on that note, hosting, there's a bunch of questions we wanted to talk to you about. So I think in particular, you know AWS, right?
AWS as in Amazon Web
Yes,
Services.
Amazon, not Adam. So we've done an episode or so talking about this, but what's your take on Amazon Web Services versus platforms as a service like Heroku or Divio? How would you, if someone came to you for advice, how would you advise thinking about that? And then maybe we can get into some horror stories or production stories of using them.
My general advice these days is that a PaaS is the solution people are looking for. Heroku, Divio, they work great out of the box. Heroku and Divio have both also like contributed to Django and definitely keep their integrations working and their tutorials up to date. There's also Elastic Beanstalk, which is the PaaS from AWS.
Yeah, they changed the name of it. It's something, I think it's something else. There's a newer Elastic Beanstalk.
Oh, did
but
they?
Yeah, but it's the, I'll look it up. But it's, yeah, that Amazon has a PaaS option.
Yeah, I've heard less good things about that, like more mixed reviews. I know Christian Glass, who's a relatively active Django blogger and user, he raves about it, but everyone else I've spoken to is like, I wouldn't use it again.
I personally found the docs very opaque, and it's not the platform as a service story that I found elsewhere, you know, Google or Heroku or with Azure, where you kind of, it's quite simple. And I found my personal experience with Elastic Beanstalk was I'm running through treacle here, like trying to make progress. And at that point, I'd just rather spin up an EC2 and do it the old way.
For anyone listening, why you should blog. So I blogged, you know, Django hosting things, and a post that I wrote came up, which I totally forgot about. So it's called AWS CodeStar. That's there.
Okay.
Yes, that's like the integrated, it brings in the code pipeline CI service and the code commit to Git hosting. And
yeah, so I think to Carlton's point, they're trying to be more of a Heroku-like option. And But yeah, so AWS, I mean, just using, you know, S3 or CDN or CloudFront, I don't even know where anything is. I mean, the underlying tech is so great, but the user experience is just garbage for me. How is it as a power user? Do you know where to go? And they change the interface every 6 months too. So I just, every time I use it personally, I get incredibly frustrated, but I don't work on huge projects myself. So
it is a bit of a maze, and with what, 300 services or something? I think the only sane thing is to maintain a kind of whitelist and like just be like, we're going to only touch these ones.
Yeah.
No, exactly that.
So at Timeout, I was in charge of the DevOps team. And over the course of a year, we migrated 26 applications to AWS. So one every 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And
that's a learning
curve. The main way we did that was with EC2 instances. We had a bit more of a polylingual environment. So some Java, some Scala, JavaScript, PHP, and Python. We kind of set out the ways to do things and stuck every application through a very similar similar setup. The main way we achieved this was with infrastructure as code, using the AWS CloudFormation tool. So we could just copy paste the setup from one app to the other as code. And a lot of it ends up being a bit of like cargo culting. Like, we know that we need this resource and that resource, but we only know it because it's in that other template.
You don't like, so, you know, interesting you say use CloudFormation rather than, I don't know, Chef or Ansible or whatever, because it
Ansible on top.
Right. Okay, because it's sort of tied into the Amazon system then, right? But it's exactly like that. If you've got an Ansible role, you're just going to reuse that role. You're not going to necessarily dig through the details every single time, because that defeats the purpose. Like, it's meant to be kind of pluggable. I know I need a cache. I need, you know, a database. I need, now here's my Ansible script. Deploy it. Brilliant. It works. And maybe it's not 100% tuned for that particular service, but it only took 20 minutes versus, you know, days it used to take to provision machines by hand and install the right dependencies. And, you know, I wouldn't go back to
that. Yeah, I think it's a bit of the same. Like, there's so much on offer in terms of services that you do have to kind of Lego brick it up, like package it. But that is why it's so overwhelming to begin with. And I think many of the decisions in terms of design are like aimed at capturing some corporate client's particular use case, and they don't really care about the average use case. So one example I think of is like when you create a Lambda function, you can hook it up to a service, but you, in CloudFormation at least, you also need to declare the middle thing, which is the permission for the one service that you provisioned to talk to the other service that you provisioned. And I think that should just be the default. Like, why do I need to give permission to things that I already just told to do things?
So like IAM and permissions and access policies, and that's where it gets to be like, oh, this is really hard now. Like, you know, you get through it and it can be a slog. But, that, you know, it's powerful, right? It's super powerful.
So what was the, when you're switching over, maybe for listeners who haven't ever done that kind of switch, so you have it on AWS, I guess maybe just like the DNS part, how do you know, so you have a duplicate copy, how do you feel comfortable that you can switch over, and then what is that switching over process like? I assume, is it just the DNS? What else are you doing?
One of the key things that we would do for every switch over is build a checklist and discuss it with the team, try and get as many points in there. It depends on your uptime goals. So if you're happy with your website going down for an hour, then switching the DNS can be the easiest switch over. And the most complicated involves like moving each individual service inside that. So maybe you move the database, then you move the cache service. And you maintain like a network connection, like a VPN between the old data center and the new one.
Mm-hmm.
And as for like checking that a copy is as good as the one that's running, the best way is to edit your etc hosts file to point to the new DNS record.
Oh, okay.
Effectively. And browse that, see that it looks right. Maybe if you have a list of the top 20 URLs to check, or someone who uses the system to step through, any automated testing also helps.
Mm. And then always do it on like a Friday afternoon, right? Before the weekend. So.
Yeah, just after you've left.
Right,
yeah,
exactly. Just
press the button as you walk out the door.
What about, do you have any experience with containers for deployments? I only ask because for my new book, Django for Professionals, you use Docker and then we use containers on Heroku. And this is a growing trend that makes a lot of sense to me, but I don't know, is that in the AWS world? Can you do containers within AWS?
Yeah, there are a number of solutions on AWS, and like the naming of them has gotten some ribbing as well. I think one was Elastic Kubernetes Service on Elastic Container Service.
Classic.
I personally have avoided containers up to this point. Like, timeout would have been one point where we considered it, but ultimately went down the EC2 route. And we looked at using EC2 with the same benefits that containers tend to bring, which is like a frozen image. So a new instance is faster create, things configured from like variables outside of that server. So you can use the EC2 user data, much like you can use environment variables in Kubernetes. Without so much of the complexity and the tool churn. VMs and EC2 in general, any VM provider, they're pretty stable in what they offer. Whereas I find even like every 6 months, there's some blog post that tells me something brand new about containers that I know I'd have to rework everything just to keep up.
Yeah, it is definitely a moving variable. But I mean, and at the same time, Kubernetes is clearly built by and for big companies with their needs. So I find that the leap from contain, you know, a couple containers to Kubernetes is a really hard one to make.
Yes. And I understand you need tools on top of it, like Helm, to really make it usable I think there is a bit of a trend towards like AWS and containers being the kind of IBM decisions of our era. So, you know, nobody got fired for choosing IBM. Maybe nobody got fired for trying containers because that's what everyone's doing.
Right. That's sort of a horrible thought, but probably true. It's also, I mean, just you mentioning your experiences and so much on the DevOps side speaks to something Carlton and I have mentioned on this podcast, which is that on the spectrum, Django is actually kind of a front-end framework. It sort of doesn't really, at massive scale, Django or another framework isn't the issue in terms of scaling up. It's the database. It's all these other things that are very separate from your programming languages and your frameworks.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the questions that I've come across on Quora recently was Simon Willison's answer to, does Django scale? And the answer was, it's just like any other framework that reads the database. It will go horizontally. It's going to be the database that's the problem.
Yeah. Well, and he said as much on the podcast, and we had Andrew Godwin on as well. It just came out today as we record. I know Simon sort of flippantly said, oh, it's sort of boring, how you shard and go horizontally. But I think his definition of boredom is different than most people's.
There was an old maxim when I was, cutting my teeth, was that the hardest thing you go is from one server to two. When it's all on one box, that's great. You can learn loads, and then you reach the limit of that one box, and you have to scale to two boxes, and that's like a whole life changing experience. But then the third box, that's just the same as what you did to get to the second box, and I think that still holds true.
Something for me to look forward to. I haven't gone off with the one box.
I think there's also the quote, there's only three numbers your computer program should take as limits, 0, 1, or infinity.
Yeah, exactly. So testing, I want to talk about testing because I know you have, you've written and spoken about it, and it's a question we get a lot about. And maybe specifically we can talk about PyTest. So for folks who don't know, this is, an addition to built-in tools that I think you've worked a lot with, that a lot of people in a professional setting use PyTest, but maybe people who are learning Django don't understand what it is or why you would use it over unit tests and the built-in Django test runner.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of PyTest. It's definitely the more Pythonic way of testing. I remember learning Django's unit test and having done a lot of Java at university, I thought it was quite natural, but then I came to realize it doesn't really fit in very well with the rest of more like idiomatic Python code that I was writing in my views and models. So I think PyTest is the only way I would write tests these days.
Hmm.
And for Django, you install the PyTest Django plugin and it hooks into your Django settings and configures the databases just like Django's test runner does.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree anecdotally. I think almost everyone I know running a production site uses PyTest. Carlton, does that ring true for you?
Yeah, well, I'm sort of in a kind of halfway house in that I use PyTest as the the testing framework, like the PyTest command. I use that every time. And I absolutely love using plain Python asserts, because I can never remember whether it's self-assert, you know, has more than or less than. I can never remember those 52 methods. I can just about remember assert equal, assert true. You know, assert num queries is kind of handy in Django land. But I'd much rather just write assert some Python expression and then, you know, a message that's kind of handy. But the thing I still do quite like and still use a lot is unit test cases, because I like them to group, use them to group. So I'm using PyTest to run them, and I'm using plain asserts inside the test cases, but I'm still using that unit test class because for the grouping that it gives me. And that's just sort of where I'm at. It's not a religious thing. It's kind of where I've reached. I haven't delved into the further realms of PyTest with the fixtures and the parameterization and those kind of things, which all look really cool, but are just one more thing for me to learn at this stage.
Well, Adam, you have a nice blog post on speeding up Django test cases, right?
Yes, I wrote this post last week.
Oh, is that right? Okay, yeah, I saw it. I guess it's the 15th of July. Yeah, so we'll link to
9 days ago.
We'll link that in the notes.
Yeah, this was with a client recently, EV.Energy. They're an electric vehicle charging optimization company. I hope I've done them justice in that explanation. So they have a not huge Django app at the moment, but it had tests running for, it was about 6 minutes, and I got them down to 2 minutes or so. And the main way of doing this was by changing the test case class from Django that was in use. So for historical reasons, they'd used the transaction test case, which I think is slightly badly named. And this has more complicated database rollback behavior than the test case, which you're recommended to use generally. And they'd used that because it fixed a bug in their testing. It made sense at the time. Mm-hmm. And the speed difference would have been noticeable when there were just maybe a few hundred tests. But now their test suite had scaled. It was now taking a not insignificant amount of time. 6 minutes is still pretty fast.
Yeah, well, that's true, right? It's pretty fast, but it's also long enough to be a nuisance. So,
yeah, it's go make a cup of tea or browse Reddit time.
Right.
It's not just wait for it. You can go read the blog post and see why it made a difference to switch down to test case for most of their test classes. But I really wrote the post because I thought this was a great story of like where to look in Django testing to have fast tests.
Yeah. And related to testing, I know you've also written on Coverage, I think, which is a fantastic package for people. And actually, Ned, who maintains it, is here in Boston. I need to get him on. But could you talk about Coverage? How would you describe Coverage to people who haven't used it before?
Sure. So Coverage is when you run a program and you keep a record of which lines were run. This isn't so easy in compiled languages, but Python makes it relatively easy. And Ned Batchelder, who creates the Coverage Python package, has maintained it for many years at this point, maybe 10 years or more, maybe. So when you run the program with Coverage, you get to see which lines have run. And so the main use case for that is to create a test suite and check which lines of your actual program, in our case a Django app, have been touched by the tests. And a goal you can set is to try to get to 100% coverage. That is, every line in your program has run.
Well, do you think that's a good goal?
I think it's a good goal. And in fact, I go one step further with the branch option, which is every branch has been taken both ways. So if there's an if in your code, it must go through both true and false. So you can't have a line of code that does like if something that's only true in your test suite.
Oh.
So you might have like if user is admin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then to run all your tests with admin, but then you haven't tested the normal user experience of your website.
This is the mind of a Django core contributor, people. fantastic. I didn't know about that. I love that.
Yeah. So my blog post guides you through how to set up Django for coverage testing, two ways, one with the Django build and test runner, or one with PyTest, which you install the PyTest cov plugin, which sets up coverage. I think everywhere I've worked at has had not 100% coverage.
Well, because
apart from once when I worked on an app on my own.
Well, because there is an argument that it's sort of a goal that isn't worth, you know, the last 10%. And so it should just be used as a metric of, that's kind of why I asked. I've heard people espouse that theory that, you know, the last 5-10% isn't worth the time.
I think it depends on the last 5-10% of what we discussed.
Yeah.
If you're building a nuclear power plant, I sincerely hope you have better testing than just 100% coverage. You know, you're testing 100% of the scenarios, hopefully.
But this is the software quality versus cost issue, right? So everyone's always like, oh, software engineering doesn't deserve the name because it's impossible to build reliable software. It's not impossible. There are standards. You know, NASA have these standards which you can use, but they cost 5 times as much to build the software. So you take that to a company and say, hey, we're going to build it to NASA standards. They're just going to throw it out the door. They want it shipped quickly, and if it's got some bugs, it doesn't matter. You know, it's that the... There's always that.
Same thing with uptime. Going from an hour to, you know, a second or something is exponential in cost and time.
Yeah, like 1 9, no problem. 2 9s, yeah, no problem. 6 9s, that's hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and related to security, I also wanted to get a chance to talk about your talk you gave at DjangoCon Europe this year on security headers, because that's, I liked how you
which folks was fantastic.
People, which is fantastic. A couple people before you had said security is boring, and you emphatically made the case that it is not. So perhaps you could give the highlights of that talk.
Sure. So the talk, which has a corresponding blog post, goes through how you set up 7 different headers on a Django site to make it more secure. This is to pass a grade on a website called securityheaders.com, which is by a security researcher called Scott Helm, and will help you get like some assurance that you are keeping your users secure. Security can be seen as boring because it's often like checking some boxes or re-auditing things you've already written. But I like to think of it from the perspective of a hacker. I kind of got into web security as a teenager on a website called hackthissite.org, which I checked recently. It's still up.
Oh.
It teaches you like the basics of all the different attacks hackers might run. And then these security headers that you can activate in Django, 4 of them come out of the box. They help you protect against all these relatively basic attacks. And if you're running a Django website without these headers on, you're definitely at more risk. They're very well known, simple attacks that you can protect against.
Yeah.
And the defaults there are things you have to turn on, or these come turned on automatically?
So some stuff is on by default in Django. I think of the headers, it's only the X-frame options that is set by default.
Yeah, if you run the deployment checklist, these will spring up. But most of them, and this is only top of mind because I just wrote these chapters for my book, only most of them are turned off by default.
Yeah. And I opened a ticket after my talk to consider turning them on by default from Django 3.0.
How's that going? Because that sounds like a good idea. Did we accept that?
Yeah, I haven't got around to that, but I think Marius took a stab at it recently.
Well, I think the challenge for maybe beginner intermediate folks is setting up the local and the production environment for testing, you know, because you want different things in both environments, and that leap, do you do it with containers? Do you do it with different settings files? It's not the responsibility of Django Core to explain that, but I think that's probably the hardest part of doing that, because everyone does it a little bit differently.
I think some of these headers are perfectly safe to activate both locally and in production.
So
definitely like X-frame options is one where there's a default and Django can just switch to the more secure default. XSS protection is another one that just helps the browser protect you against injection attacks.
Yeah, fair enough. I think there's, I'm pretty sure there's 9 things that in the deployment checklist you need to switch. And one of those, I think 2 of those, it's like debug and allowed hosts, and the other 7 are largely header related.
Yeah, and there's all system checks for these that if you run manage.py check with your with the deploy flag with your production settings, you get the messages. But I've found a number of my clients slash friends have not gone through the deployment checklist when deploying.
So are there any other projects or packages you want to give a shout out to?
I have a projects page on my site that describes some of the things I make. Aside from Django MySQL, there are a number of smaller packages that work with Django. One of them is for a security header. That's Django feature policy. That's for a draft security header called feature policy that enables disabling features in the web browser that you don't want to use.
Like webcam, say, or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. So if someone injects adverts onto your site, you're not going to let them ask for the webcam of your visitors.
Sounds like a good idea.
Yeah. those are the main things I'm working on. You can see on my projects page.
And then how are you finding, I'm always curious, life as a freelancer? Because you've worked at companies. Obviously, the mix works for you. How would you describe the difference between those two lifestyles? Why make the switch?
Yeah. I made the switch in January mostly because I wanted to explore the ecosystem a bit more, I might say. So I find it quite stimulating to jump between different projects and help people out in various capacities. And it's quite interesting in that regard. Also, I think it's helping me like make some better decisions for Django Core. I'm no longer stuck on one big website that I'm thinking about like, oh, most users are ending up not doing this, like not activating these security headers. So hopefully I can feed that back in. The lifestyle wise, like at the start, I didn't have much work coming in. I found it a bit stressful thinking about how am I going to pay rent this month or pay for that. But on the flip side, like it's a lot more flexibility and freedom. And when work does come my way, sometimes I'm turning it down these days.
Yeah. So. I mean, the interesting thing with freelancing is the pipeline is that you've got to always see what's coming up next. And, you know, if you get sucked into a current project and don't work the pipeline, you're suddenly, your project finishes and you've got some money and you've got a nice break, but you haven't got any work coming in. It's like, I needed to be doing the client development, the business development work, whilst the other project was still going on. And learning to manage that is, you know, it's the freelance, but it's the business side of freelancing.
Yeah. Well, there is a middle ground where you work for a consultancy, so they sort of tee up the projects for you and you sacrifice a little bit, I guess, in terms of pay, but you don't have that. You don't have to spend all that time on business development and marketing and all the rest that does, you know, it can be challenging, right, to spend all day teeing up projects and not actually coding and not actually getting paid.
Yeah, I've got a number of friends who do contracting that way in London. It seems to be quite a popular way of moving developers between projects as well. And a lot of companies are engaging with that.
Yeah. Great. Well, Adam, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and share all your work on Django with us.
Yeah, super. Thanks for coming on, Adam. That's great.
Oh, and we should mention, Carlton, for if people want to listen to the podcast, you can find it on your favorite podcast player. It's on djangochat.com. And if you have feedback, you can leave it on the site or on Twitter. We're at @chatdjango. So again, Adam, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Adam.
Thank you very much for having me.